a subject incorporated in the discussion in one of our last Sunday school classes, the adult Sunday school class. And I don't know if it was last week or the week before. I lose track of time. But it has come up before, and it's something that you hear from people a lot. And I was led to look up some scriptures on this subject and impressed with a thought. And that thought was that God has a plan. And the thing that you hear is that something happened 500, 600, 700 years ago by the early founders of our church, or Joseph Smith did this or that, and so we have to change it in order for the church to make progress. Or we hear that the reason that the church isn't going forward and isn't making progress is because we aren't practicing this or that doctrine, or doing something that someone thinks we are directed to do. Or the classic one is that we don't have miracles anymore, and that's because we have let our righteousness fall and are not worthy. Well, I'd like to address those things, because I think this attitude is not only wrong, but it's dangerous. And I'll tell you why. The why is because God has a plan. First off, I want to make an assertion. God is really not concerned overall with our well-being or status in this world. But he is concerned about the status of our souls. What we do with our lives as far as getting rich or being poor or going here or going there is our business. And for the most part, I don't really think God interferes in those things, except maybe to protect us once in a while when we're not being cognizant of what we're doing. But he's looking at the big picture. And so I want to start out this evening in John 17, and I want to read verses 13 through 16. This is Jesus speaking, and he says, "And now come I to thee," praying to God, "to these things I speak in the world, that they might have my joy fulfilled in themselves. I have given them thy word, and the world hath hated them, because they are not of the world," speaking of his disciples, "even as I am not of the world. I pray not that thou shouldst take them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from evil. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world." And so we glibly say from time to time that we need to remember that we are in the world, but not of it. And Jesus didn't want them taken out of the world, but only protected against the evil. Part of God's plan. Let's go to Titus. Second chapter. I'm going to read the 11th and 12th verse. "For the grace of God that bringeth salvation hath appeared to all men, teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lusts, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present world." That's our mission. And that's what God is concerned with. Second point that I'd like to make is that God says we are to have joy. And when he says we are to have joy, I don't believe that he means joy in this world, joy in things like all the sports games, or joy in our worldly accomplishments, but joy spiritually, and there is a difference. Let's go to 2 Nephi, first chapter. I'm going to start with the 34th verse, and the verse I want to bear down on is 35, but 34th kind of sets the stage. But behold, his will be done, for his ways are righteousness forever, and he hath said that inasmuch as ye shall keep my commandments, ye shall prosper in the land. But inasmuch as you will not keep my commandments, you shall be cut off from my presence. And now that my soul might have joy in you, and that my heart might leave this world with gladness because of you, that I might not be brought down with grief and sorrow to the grave. Speaking of spiritual joy. And still in 2 Nephi, and in this first chapter, let's go over to verse 115. Top of page 86, and I'm plucking this right out of a series of verses that present an overall thought, but Adam fell that men might be, and men are, that they might have joy. And the Messiah cometh in the fullness of time that he may redeem the children of men from the fall. That joy... The rain falls on the just and the unjust. And I want to read that scripture. It's in Matthew. It's in chapter 5. It's on the Sermon on the Mount, and it's verse 45. I'm going to start with 44, but 45 is the one I quoted. 44 says, "But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on evil and on good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust." I'd like to draw those of you that are, especially the men here that are would-be chefs, you know, when you're trying to cook outdoors and you got your grill going and you put the steaks on and you salt the steaks. You salt the gristle and the fat and the meaty portion and the connective tissue. And if you aren't careful how you took them out of the package, maybe even some of the plastic they were wrapped in. But it's awfully hard to salt one piece of the steak. It gets sprinkled on everything. And I get this flash through my mind when I think of this scripture. That's kind of how God is when he says that the rain falls on the just and on the unjust. Calamities befall us in this life, and sometimes they involve some of those that are innocent. Some of those that in our own mind we say, well, they didn't have it coming. And then somebody may escape something, and you say, boy, how'd he get away with that? Some people will say, well, that's the luck of the draw. No, there's no luck to it. This world is presented, and we're in it, and things happen. And our job is to be righteous, to follow God's commandments, to live the best we can, no matter what befalls us or what phase of life we're in. That's the trial. Not whether we're successful or not successful, whether we are graduates or not graduates or whatever. Those are things we've invented. And I want to read you a couple stories out of the scriptures, and I hope I can get them in tonight, because they show this. Sometimes the righteous aren't always the winners. And you say, why did God do that? God has a plan. Let's think of the children of Israel. They were in captivity, about 400 years before Moses led them out. And they prayed for deliverance. God told Moses that he'd heard their prayers and he was going to deliver them. Now, at the end of the first 100 years they were in captivity, all those people that had prayed probably were beginning to wonder why God didn't deliver them. After all, they were doing everything he said. They were praying to him. And so they probably turned to their leaders or their priests or whoever and said, if you guys would just do this or do that, or maybe it's because you're not doing this or doing that, that's why God doesn't deliver us. It's all your fault, because that's human nature. And so by the time they were 200 years into captivity, it's hard to say where the blame was being laid. And 300 years, and 400. And by this time, probably they were beginning to wonder if it would ever happen. Did God lie to them? God had a plan. And then suddenly, Moses is brought forth and he leads them out of captivity. Now, those people who prayed the week before Pharaoh released them probably thought, aha, we did it right. God has now answered our prayers. I've been telling you, we should have been doing it this way all along, and we'd have gotten out of Egypt a lot quicker. No. God had a plan. He knew they had to stay in Egypt 400 years because he had some things he had to teach Israel. They didn't think so. And then he had to prepare the right man. And it had to be somebody like Moses who came up through Egyptian royalty, in order to be able to come back and have an audience with Pharaoh, although Pharaoh didn't like him, to make it work. And God knew all this, and he had a plan. The children of Israel just didn't know that was the plan. And so it is with our life. I've heard people say, we need to gather. The reason the church isn't moving forward is we haven't had a gathering. We've got to build Zion today. Let me ask you a question. Where in the scriptures does it say that we will gather ourselves and that we will build Zion? It doesn't say that. God says, how many times would I have gathered you, but you wouldn't? And he says in the Book of Mormon, I won't read it, but that he's going to build Zion. And it won't happen till he's in our presence with power and authority. Fifth chapter of 3 Nephi. Sometimes we get to thinking we're in control, but God has a plan, and it'll happen when he decides it will happen. And we have a tendency to want to run before him. Give you a present day example. Why is the church suddenly moving in its ministerial efforts? We have efforts in four countries overseas. We have money to support it, which is just absolutely unheard of in the Church of Christ. And we didn't 50, 60, 70 years ago, with men who desperately wanted to and preached it all the time. Were they doing something wrong? Are we doing something better today that they didn't do? Do we need to change something, some doctrine or something that underlying here? I don't think so. I don't know what it was that God wanted to put in place, but the reason we're in Africa is because Margaret Mura saw our address in the front of a Book of Mormon that her grandfather had, that had in fact been given to him by a missionary from another church. And at the same time, Brother Brian had a vision one day at work before he retired as a policeman. And he saw himself in Africa, and not on safari. but in Africa as a missionary. I've kind of shortened that story. It's a little longer when Brian tells it, but why? Because God's timetable was moving along, and he said, now is the time, and he began to put the wheels in motion. We didn't do anything to cause that. It's all part of God's plan. Let's back up a little and look at some stories and scriptures from history. And remembering in these that I'm going to read you that sometimes the innocent or the just are allowed to be destroyed. And we wonder why. What's fair about that? But first, let's go to 3 Nephi 4. Verse 66. Read through 70. This is right after the great calamity befell this country, this nation, only it wasn't the present nation, the Americas, at the time just before Christ coming to this land. And there were earthquakes, and cities were destroyed, and people were destroyed. And starting at verse 66, it says, and it was the more righteous part of the people who were saved. And it was they who received the prophets and stoned them not, and it was they who had not shed the blood of the saints who were spared. And they were spared and were not sunk and buried up in the earth, and they were not drowned in the depths of the sea, and they were not burned by fire, neither were they fallen upon and crushed to death. And they were not carried away in the whirlwind, neither were they overpowered by the vapor of smoke and darkness. And now whosoever readeth, let him understand. He that hath the scriptures, let him search them. And see and behold, if all these deaths and destruction by fire and by smoke and by tempest and by whirlwinds and by the opening of the earth to receive them, and all these things are not unto the fulfilling of prophecies of many of the holy prophets. There's a key to the plan. Behold, I say unto you, yea, many have testified of these things of the coming of Christ, and they were slain because they testified of these things. And we know that's true. People wouldn't believe the prophets and they slayed them. Yet they prophesied the truth. But it's part of God's plan. And those prophets were taken home to God. They are martyrs. And that's what God is concerned with. The soul of the prophet. Not life or death. And we have a terrible time with that concept. Let's go to Matthew in the 10th chapter. Thirty-ninth verse. He that findeth his life shall lose it. And he that loseth his life for my sake shall find it. That's scattered throughout the New Testament. All kinds of places. We read it. We glibly quote it. But do we understand what it means? If we choose Christ and serve him, and then we happen to lose our life for his sake, we have automatic salvation as a martyr. Whether we lose our life is not the important thing. It's the service to him. Go over to Matthew 16. Yes, Matthew 16. 25 and 26. This is Jesus speaking. And whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. For what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man gain in exchange for his soul? It's a question of priorities. Which is the more important? And I think in Matthew 39, is there a 39? No, here, let's go back to, I read you 39 of chapter 10. Let's very quickly read from 34 to 39. 34 says, "Think not that I am come to send peace on earth." There's a cross-reference here. The idea can also be found in Hebrews. "I came not to send peace, but a sword. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father, the daughter against her mother, the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's foes shall be they of his own household. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." He's using something there that the Israelites understood. The family was the big thing, and rightly it should be, but they almost worshiped the patriarch of the family. What he said was law. And there was more allegiance given there than Christ apparently thought there should be. We should look for truth and follow what is right. And there can be a difference. And so he was using something that was near and dear to their heart and pointing out the error of that way. Let's look at two dramatic stories from the scriptures and look a little more at God's plan. Let's go to Alma. Alma 10. I want to start with verse 40. This is talking about the conversion of Zeezrom and his martyrdom, but it brings a little more into the story with Alma and Amulek. Starting at, verse 40. "And it came to pass that Zeezrom was astounded at the words which had been spoken, and he also knew concerning the blindness of the minds which had caused among the people by his lying words." You see, he had been preaching evil. "And his soul began to be harrowed up under a consciousness of his own guilt. Yea, he began to be encircled about by the pains of hell. And it came to pass that he began to cry unto the people, saying, Behold, I am guilty, and these men are spotless before God." That's Alma and Amulek. "And he began to plead for them from that time forth. But they reviled him, saying, Art thou also possessed with the devil? And they, his people, spit upon him and cast him out from among them, and also all those who believed in the words which had been spoken by Alma and Amulek. And they cast them out and sent men to cast stones at them. And they brought their wives and children together, and whosoever believed or had been taught to believe in the word of God, they caused that they should be cast into the fire. And it came to pass that they took Alma and Amulek and carried them forth to the place of martyrdom, that they might witness the destruction of all those who were consumed by fire." And this is typical of the stories of the Book of Mormon and of the way the people fought and the way people think today. They thought they'd bring Alma and Amulek forward and they'd see all this destruction and they'd say, "See, your words aren't true. You're wrong. You don't have any power." And then they always taunt them. "If you're so hot, stop this. Put a cause to the end of all this destruction." Let's read on. "And when Amulek saw the pains of the women and children who were consuming in the fire, he was also pained, and he said to Alma, How can we witness this awful scene? Therefore, let us stretch forth our hands and exercise the power of God which is in us and save them from the flames." And they could have done that. But Alma said unto him, "The Spirit constraineth me that I must not stretch forth mine hand, for behold, the Lord receiveth them up unto himself in glory." They were innocent. They believed the truth. And they died for it. And I imagine people standing around wondered what they did wrong. And of course, that made the unbeliever think he was right. And the power of his kings or soldiers or whoever had control of them and was doing the destruction, that made them feel good. Why, we ask ourselves. The answer is, God has a plan. Let's read it. 51, Alma saying to Amulek, "And he doth suffer that they may do this thing, or that the people may do this thing unto them, according to the hardness of their hearts, that the judgments which he, God, shall exercise upon them in his wrath may be just." In other words, there isn't going to be any way out when those folks stand before the judgment bar. He's going to say, "Remember what you did? And the blood of the innocent shall stand as a witness against them." This is verse 52. "Yea, and cry mightily against them at the last day." What was important in this story? The witness of Alma and Amulek, and that they would be proven right. The truth that the people might believe, but not whether they lived or died. It was their souls went to heaven. That's what God won. But our human minds have a problem with that concept. Let's read 53 and 54. "Now Amulek said unto Alma, Behold, perhaps they will burn us also." Amulek was beginning to get a little nervous. And Alma said, "Be it according to the will of the Lord, but behold, our work is not finished, therefore they burn us not." And they didn't. Now there's a little more to the story. I look at it as the good ending. But remember, it's part of God's plan. Alma and Amulek were bound and put in prison, and they were smitten and terrorized. And the leaders of the land came unto them and taunted them, teased them, ridiculed them. Let's go to verse 73. And this is after many, many things have happened to them. "And it came to pass after they had thus suffered for many days, and it was on the 12th day in the 10th month in the 10th year of the reign of the judges over the people of Nephi, that the chief judge over the land of Ammonihah and many of their teachers and lawyers went into the prison where Alma and Amulek were bound with cords. And their chief judge stood before them and smote them again and said unto them, If you have power of God, deliver yourselves from these bands. And then we will believe the Lord will destroy this people according to your words. And it came to pass that they all went forth and smote them, saying the same words, even until the last." I don't know how many people they had trooping in there, but it sounds like there were quite a few. "And when the last had spoken unto them, the power of God was upon Alma and Amulek, and they arose and stood upon their feet, and Alma said, cried, saying, How long shall we suffer these great afflictions, O Lord? O Lord, give us strength according to our faith which is in Christ, even unto deliverance. And they brake their cords with which they were bound. When the people saw this, they began to flee." Right there. It was too late for those people. Suddenly scared them. These guys broke their cords. "And when the people saw this, they began to flee, for the fear of destruction had come upon them. And it came to pass that so great was their fear that they fell to the earth and did not obtain the outer door of the prison. And the earth shook mightily, and the walls of the prison were rent in twain, so that they fell to the earth. And the chief judge and the lawyers and the priests and the teachers were smote, who smote upon Alma and Amulek, were slain by the fall thereof. And Alma and Amulek came forth out of the prison, and they were not hurt, for the Lord had granted unto them power according to their faith which was in Christ. And they straightway came forth out of the prison, and they were loosed from their bands. And the prison had fallen to the earth, and every soul who was within the walls thereof, save it were Alma and Amulek, were slain. And they straightway came forth into the city. Verse 84, now the people, having heard a great noise, came running together by multitudes to know the cause of it. And when they saw Alma and Amulek coming forth out of the prison, and the walls thereof had fallen to the earth, they were struck with great fear and fled from the presence of Alma and Amulek, even as a goat fleeth with her young from two lions. And thus they did flee from the presence of Alma and Amulek. But you look back and say, what about all those women and children that they could have saved? That's not the point. God wanted to accomplish something here. He brought out the most vile evil from the people, showed it to them themselves, and then they got the retribution. God does have a plan. Reminds me of the story of Samson. Remember when they took him to the temple? Everybody was inside the temple, and whoever it was leading him by the hand, I forget now. He asked him, he said, is this the right place? And asked him if everybody was there, and said, position me between certain pillars, and they did. He was still chained, I believe. But at that point, he had his strength back, and he tore the two pillars down, and the whole temple fell in and killed everybody. Of course, he lost his life, but God accomplished something. He had a plan. Let's go to 1 Samuel in the Bible. An Old Testament story that is a good one. 22nd chapter. It's one of the stories about David. I'm going to start with verse 6. This is after Goliath. David is being revered by the people. Saul is jealous, and he wants to get David. He wants to kill him. And he's chasing him out in the wilderness. And he's been chasing him for some time. Starting at verse 6 in 1 Samuel 22. When Saul heard that David was discovered and the men that were with him, then Saul said unto his servants that stood about him, hear now, you Benjaminites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains and thousands and captains of hundreds? That all of you have conspired against me, that there is none that showeth me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse. He's talking about Jonathan there. And there is none of you that is sorry for me. He was sorry for himself. Or showeth unto me that my son hath stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, which was set over the servants of Saul, and said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, and Amalek, and the son of Ahib And he inquired of the Lord of him, and gave him victuals, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Then the king sent to call Amalek the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, the priests that were in Nob. And they came all of them to the king. And Saul said, hear now, thou son of Ahitub. And he answered, here I am, my lord. And Saul said unto him, why have you conspired against me, thou the son of Jesse, in that thou hast given him bread and a sword that has inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait as at this day? Then Ahimelech answered the king and said, and who is so faithful among all thy servants as David, which is the king's son-in-law, and goeth at thy bidding, and is honorable in thine house? He was pleading the cause here to Saul for David. Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Be it far from me, let not the king impute anything upon this servant, nor to all the house of my father, for thy servant knew nothing of all this, less or more. And the king said, thou shalt surely die, Ahimelech, thou and all thy father's house. And the king said unto the footmen that stood about him, turn and slay the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled and did not show it to me. But the servants of the king would not put forth their hand to fall upon the priests of the Lord. Isn't that interesting? He is so jealous and so wrought up, he wants these men to kill all the priests of the land. Or that land right there at Nob. But his servants wouldn't do it. I can just imagine their thoughts. You got to be kidding, Saul. Kill all the priests? Even that slowed them down, stopped them a little. But Saul was determined. And the king said to Doeg, turn, and he's the one who told that David had received counsel and also the sword of Goliath from the priests, back in verse 9. The king said to Doeg, turn thou and fall upon the priests. And Doeg the Edomite turned and fell upon the priests and slew on that day 85 persons that did wear the linen ephod. Why did God let that happen? And Nob, the city of priests, smote he with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and sucklings, oxen, asses, and sheep, with the edge of the sword. But verse 20. And one of the sons of Elimelech, the son of Ahitub, and Abiathar escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar showed David that Saul had slain the Lord's priests. And David said unto Abiathar, I knew it that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of thy father's house. Abide thou with me, fear not, for he that seeketh my life seeketh thy life. But with me thou shalt be in safeguard. Now let's go to chapter 24. Starting with verse 1, chapter 24. And it came to pass, when Saul was returned from following the Philistines, that it was told him, saying, behold, David is in the wilderness in Engedi. Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men of all Israel and went to seek David and his men upon the rocks of the wild goats. And he came to the sheepcotes by the way, where was a cave, and Saul went in to cover his feet, and David and his men remained in the sides of the cave. They were hiding in there. And you remember this story. Saul decided he was going to take a nap. And the men of David said unto him, behold, the day of which the Lord said unto thee, behold, I will deliver thine enemies into thine hand, that thou mayest do to him as it shall seem good unto thee. Then David arose and cut off the skirt of Saul's robe privily. And it came to pass afterward that David's heart smote him because he had cut off Saul's skirt. And he said unto his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing unto my master and the Lord's anointed, to stretch forth my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of God. David said, no, he's the anointed of God. I can't do him in. So David stayed his servants with their swords, with these words, and suffered them not to rise against Saul, but Saul rose up out of the cave and went on his way. Now let's move forward to verse 16. Afterwards, David went on his way with his men, and they happened to cross paths. I don't know if they were, one was further up the road than the other, or up on the side of the mountain, or just the geology of it, but they're yelling at each other. And David says to Saul, and it came to pass when David had made an end of speaking these words unto Saul, Saul said, is this thy voice, my son David? And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. And he said to David, Thou art a more righteous man than I, for thou hast rewarded me good, whereas I have rewarded thee evil. David has just told him, I cut off your skirt, robe. I could have killed you. And he showed it to him. And so Saul here is aware that he came awful close to losing his life. And thou hast showed this day how that thou hast dealt with me, for as much as when the Lord had delivered me into thine hand, thou killedst me not. For if a man find his enemy, will he let him go well anyway? Wherefore the Lord reward thee good for that thou hast done unto me this day. And now behold, I know well that thou shalt David and his men got them up into the hold. In other words, they stayed in the wilderness and in hiding. And so Saul, having seen that that was the end of it, he repented and was good from then on, right? No, the story goes on. Because God has a plan. Now, when I get through reading the story, I want you to tell me what the plan was. So be thinking about that. Let's go to the 26th chapter. I'm going to have to hustle. 26th chapter of 1 Samuel, first verse. And the Ziphites came unto Saul in Gibeth, saying, Doth not David hide himself in the hills of Chilah, which is before Jesimon? You see, Saul's out having a battle here and protecting his lands. And the people come unto him and say, Hey, we just happened to hear that David's in the country. Did you know that? And Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having 3,000 chosen men of Israel with him to seek David in the wilderness. Here we go again. He didn't learn from having his robe cut off. The story reminds you a little of Moses and Pharaoh. And Saul pitched in the hill of Hachilah, which is before Jeshimon, by the way, but David abode in the wilderness, and he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness. And David therefore sent out spies, and understood that Saul was come in very deed. And David arose and came to the place where Saul had pitched. And David beheld the place where Saul lay, and Abner, the son of Ner, the captain of his hosts, and Saul lay in the trench, and the people pitched around him. So they've set up camp, and they're protecting him. His soldiers are all around him. Then answered David, said to Ahimelech the Hittite, and to Abisha, the son of Zeruiah, brother of Joab, saying, Who will go down with me to Saul to the camp? Abishai said, I will go down with thee. So David and Abishai came to the people by night. And behold, Saul lay sleeping within the trench, and his spear stuck in the ground at his bolster. But Abner and the people lay around about him. Then said Abishai to David, God hath delivered thine enemy into thine hand this day. Now therefore let me smite him, I pray thee, with the spear even to the earth at once, and I will not smite him the second time. Abishai was going to do him in with his own spear. And David said to Abishai, Destroy him not, for who can stretch forth his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? David said, Furthermore, as the Lord liveth, the Lord shall smite him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall descend into the battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch forth mine hand against the Lord's anointed. But I pray thee, take now the spear that is at his bolster, and the cruse of water, and let us go. So David took the spear and the cruse of water from Saul's bolster, and they got away, and no man saw it. No man knew it, neither awaked, for they were all asleep, because a deep sleep from the Lord was fallen upon them. This is all part of God's plan. David wasn't a sound tactician any more than Saul was. This wasn't all happenstance. It's part of Saul's, or sorry, part of God's plan. Then we move down to verse 21. Once again, well, I'll read verse 17. Once again, they cross paths. I think it says here, this time David is up on the mountain and Saul is in the valley. David hollers at him. And Saul knew David's voice and said, "Is this thy voice, my son David?" And David said, "It is my voice, my lord, O king." And he said, "Wherefore doth my lord thus pursue after this servant? For what have I done, or what evil is in mine hand?" Then if we go down to verse 21. Then said Saul, "I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do thee harm, because my soul was precious in thine eyes this day." David has showed him his spear and his cruse of water. So Saul knows he was there. And David answered and said, "Behold the king's spear, and let one of the young men come over and fetch it." I'll bet that guy was shaking in his boots. "And the Lord rendered to every man his righteousness and his faithfulness, for the Lord delivered thee into my hand today, but I would not stretch forth mine hand against the Lord's anointed. And behold, as thy life was much set by this day in mine eyes, so let my life be much set by in the eyes of the Lord, and let him deliver me out of all tribulation." Then Saul said to David, "Blessed be thou, my son David, that thou shalt both do great things and also shalt prevail." So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. And that still is part of God's plan. Do you know what that plan was? What was accomplished by all that? Or was that just a story of military workings, of the in-between battles? Because all this time, Saul is fighting the Syrians and all the people around Israel, it's kind of, and in a couple of instances, David brought his men and came to Saul's rescue and helped defeat the enemy. But then they took off before Saul could get a hold of them. What did all that prove? God had a plan. Jesus Christ was to come from the stem of Jesse and from the seed of David. He had to establish David as the absolute ruler of the people. And although he was much loved, and they wrote stories about him because of killing Goliath, he really didn't have the political clout, if you want to use the language, to lead the nation. And so God created this plan. And the more Saul chased David, the more the people loved him. And the more David got away and was kind to Saul, the more they loved him. Conversely, the more they disliked Saul. He lost in popularity. At that one point, even his own people said, "No, we don't want to kill the priest." But he found one underling that would do it. And some innocents perished. And then we went through a repetition of this, Saul letting David go, and then David appearing again, and then Saul letting him go. And each time Saul said, "Oh no, it's going to be wonderful." And then when he finds out where he is in the countryside, he wants to go kill him. It created an atmosphere for Israel that would bring David into the position of being able to lead all 12 tribes. The Benjaminites and Judah were ready at this time, but the other tribes weren't ready. And they didn't really fall into place political, and the nation didn't become one under David until Saul was killed in battle, along with his three sons. And you remember that story where he fell upon his own sword, because his sword bearer wouldn't kill him when the Philistines had wounded him and were about to capture him. But after that, David was able to rally all of the tribes, and they came together in one nation under God. That was God's plan. But I'm sure that as they went along, the different ones that were players in this act, if you will, they didn't know what was going on beyond tomorrow or the battle or where they were. They were sort of pawns in this overall scheme of things. But God was in control and knew what he was doing. And I stress, some of these stories are pretty bloody, but the people who lost their lives were martyrs and were granted automatic, instantaneous salvation. We have a mission then. Our mission is to take the gospel to others, is to preach it, teach it, practice it, and not worry about gatherings in Zion and some of these things. When God gets ready, it will happen. Let me ask you a question. Do you want to be part of that if it happens in your lifetime? Yes. Then what do we have to do to qualify? We have to be like David. We have to do the right thing. That's our job, not to try to orchestrate or manipulate or legislate what's happening. We can't run before the Lord. And history, what's gone on before, is history. We cannot change it. And it doesn't do us any good to argue about it or to browbeat each other over it. We have to accept it and go on and do what's right. We have a responsibility in the church, to our families, to our children, like that little guy back there, that they get raised up in the Lord's way. That's our job. And God will take care of the rest. God bless you all.
Thank you. If you will, remember the announcements and try to make as many of those activities as you can. Would you close or open your books to number 81 for our closing song?
Thank you.